Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Ira Harris and David Rosenberg. Ira's hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He is currently a CME director and was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003. David is chief economist and strategist at Gluskin Sheff. He served as the chief economist for Merrill Lynch and is one of the 12 smartest people on Wall Street by Business Insider. Welcome, gentlemen.
Well, thanks for having us on, and I just want to find out who those other 11 people are.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. Okay. It's great to be with you, Richard. Thanks. And David, yeah. Of course, always.
I thought we'd begin with a discussion in Europe, the end of the Draghi era. You've written a lot about that recently. Ira, your thoughts on that? Do you see continued financial repression in Europe and the potential for a Eurobond?
Well, I mean, the financial repression and the potential for a Eurobond are two different subjects. The Draghi era is over, and I think it's very healthy for the entire global financial system, because I think he pushed it to certain areas that I think that are going to be difficult to deal with. And of course, one of those is a fallout from the Eurobond. But I really, for several weeks, have thought why Lagarde. Because I, from a banking standpoint, I didn't think it was a very good choice. Politically, yes, I understand it, because I think she's one of the few in Europe with the political heft to, you know, to me, there's a dual mandate that she confronts, which is what to do with all that paper that exists on the balance sheet of the ECB, and how to motivate and stimulate, especially the Germans and the Dutch and the Austrians, into some type of well-needed, and I'm not one who usually comes from that school of thought, but it's well-needed, and I think they have the budget room for it, for real fiscal stimulus with massive infrastructure spending. And I think that they think that Lagarde is the one who will be able to do that. Those are her two mandates. Forget about the silly mandate that Draghi always speak to. In fact, he went out, he exited yesterday speaking to it. So that's what confronts, and how it shakes the world going forward will be what I have to be concerned with. But I think that's where we sit right now.
And your thoughts, David?
Well, look, I think that there has always been this dissent within the ECB between the North and the South, and it certainly has become a lot more vocal by the hawks over the course of, say, the past month. But we're replacing, you know, one super dove, Draghi, with another super dove, Lagarde. I think maybe the biggest difference could be that Lagarde will put more pressure on fiscal policymakers to take the baton. But I don't expect that she's going to be carrying out any different of an ultra pro-accommodative monetary policy for an extended period of time than Draghi did. So I think maybe we'll call her super duper Christine as opposed to super Mario. But I think that policy is not going to shift under her tenure.
And just overall, do you see a movement towards increasing levels of fiscal stimulus in Europe in the, by the European Central Bank and the European community?
I just don't see it. I mean, there's no doubt that you could argue that that Germany is the one country that has the latitude, but fiscal balance in Germany is like a religion as part of their culture. I think that there is this pervasive belief among the growth bulls that at any moment we're going to be having a major fiscal stimulus package. I don't think that it's that easy. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. I do think that probably at some point later into the recession phase, there'll be a lot more pressure for fiscal ease, and we may see it then. But you got to keep in mind here that we're all talking about this at the peak in the stock market, the lows in unemployment coming off 10 years of economic expansion. And you could just sense the fragility, the fact that we have to even be discussing the prospect for fiscal stimulus at a time, for example, where global unemployment and certainly even unemployment in the EU and in the euro area are at either cycle lows or all-time lows. This is actually what you have to wrap your head around. If you looked at where interest rates are globally, if you looked at where equity markets are globally, and you look at where unemployment rates are globally, you wouldn't have thought that, boy, we'd be in such a precarious situation that we have to be begging for fiscal stimulus. The problem is that who's going to do the fiscal stimulus? It's nice to talk about it. Even in the United States, the 13-letter word for motherhood is infrastructure. And of course, right now, everybody's talking about that the Germans must embark on some infrastructure package at a time when their unemployment rate is below 5% and the lowest that it's been, notwithstanding the recession and angst in the manufacturing sector. That's the reality. So where are you going to be getting the workers? Anywhere, the skilled workers to be engaged in performing the infrastructure stimulus everybody is crying out for. Normally, you do that when there's a mountain of unemployment, tremendous idled capacity, and you bring those idled workers into the workforce to get them to pave riverbeds and build bridges and improve the roadways. So the fiscal stimulus will certainly come, but things will have to get materially worse before it does.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, David brings up all the absolute points that have to be made as to, that it's, of course, it's not a layup in any way, shape, or form, although I did find it interesting that the architect or the author of the Schwarzenau yesterday in the FT came out in favor of its rescission for the moment because he, stated all the ostensible reasons. And I think David's point about workers is certainly probably the most important because, we always did this to close output gaps. Oh, there's a phrase. There is where we reside. Of course, everybody, but the question that will first have to be answered, and I keep asking it to myself, is in fact the, let me step back, is in fact the German guarantee of the ECB, and unlike Jerome Powell, I still believe that the rates in Europe are only so low because there's an implicit guarantee of European debt by the Germans. It can't get away from it. I mean, how else can we describe actually short-term Greek debt being negative, Italian 10 years being 85 basis points? There's an implicit guarantee. Well, does an implicit guarantee, and I'm sure we're going to hear this argument from people in Germany, mean that that is, in fact, fiscal stimulus on the part of the German authorities? Because if the German taxpayer is going to undergo a tax or some type of hit to their personal balance sheets, if there was an absolute default in the European Union, then it becomes a fiscal event. So I'm always of the belief that Draghi was too clever by half and that there's a lot to be paid for it. And, I wouldn't really want to be in Christine. It's not like I'm afraid of a challenge, but Christine Lagarde is walking in to a very, very difficult situation left by, to her by Draghi, who, that was his answer to everything. Buy more and cut more. And I don't think that it really has left Ms. Lagarde a very enviable position. But the proof will be in how she handles what's confronting her. But I still have to deal with that question: is in fact the German guarantee the implicit guarantee an actual fiscal event in its own?
And what about the European bond market, David? Do you see that as the potential for
the initiation of a phase two in the financial crisis, phase one being about 10 years ago from mainly, you know, stemming from North America. Do you see that as the epicenter of where the financial crisis could come from in the European bond market?
Well, I'm not so sure about that. I'm not even so sure that necessarily the next crisis is going to come from Europe, unless you know, we get into a real destabilizing situation surrounding Brexit. I mean, we could look at this situation as to, you know, whether or not the bond market and these negative yields in Europe make any sense. Or you can step back and say, well, you know, as a market price, you know, what is this telling us? And it's not just Europe. It's you can argue that in the United States, we don't have negative interest rates. But I've yet to see anybody come and give an explanation as to why it is. A year ago, we're sitting at 3.25 on the 10-year note, and today we're $1.75. Nobody's come up with an adequate explanation as to why the 10-year note has come down 150 basis points in short order, except to say, well, but well, this is what's happening in the rest of the world. Well, you know, it's one global bond market. All these markets are correlated, and all the economies are correlated. We've never had a more inextricably linked global capital market and economy before, and that's not changing, even if Donald Trump wants to eradicate global supply chains. This interaction isn't changing. And what's happened is that we have had a global contraction in capital spending. We have had a shift in the investment curve to the left, which means that we have a deficiency of investment globally relative to desired savings. This is classic economics 101. And what you get is you get reduced output growth and you get lower interest rates. That's what's happened. That's what the bond market in Europe has been telling you. That's what the bond market everywhere has been telling you. So I don't necessarily look at some bond market in Europe as being indicating that there's a bubble there to burst. I think that we have to understand that the bond markets everywhere are telling you a very powerful story from a macroeconomic standpoint. Let me just add that with all deference to the stock market rally, which continues to be fueled by share buybacks, we can see that even though earnings are beating expectations, earnings are still down 4% year over year. And the market continues to hang in very well, that much we know, perhaps because of where interest rates are. And interest rates might give you an inflated multiple, but interest rates are also telling you something about the profit landscape, which is that we are in a profits recession. But as I digress, this was the first global economic expansion of all time. I may have to take the data back to the 1930s, where the global output gap never closed. We never saw this cycle, despite the impressive duration. The veracity and magnitude was so weak that the aggregate demand curve never crossed above the aggregate supply curve, which is why we never really got any meaningful global inflation, as you normally do in a positive economic growth cycle. First time ever that the output gap didn't close. And here we have 2 weeks ago, alongside the downgraded IMF forecast, the OECD leading indicator declining for the 20th month in a row. In the U.S., it's down 16 months in a row. Globally, the leading indicator is down 20 months in a row to the lowest level since 2009, the tail end of the Great Recession, which is telling me, therefore, that this output gap, which never closed, is going to go more negative, which means more downward pressure on global inflation at a time when global inflation this cycle peaked at the grand total of 2%. Global inflation peaked at 4% in 2006. At least back then, the output gap did close. And then next thing you know, we're talking about deflation in 08 and 09, but of course that was housing deflation and credit deflation and equity market deflation. This is going to be consumer price deflation. And at a time when debts globally are at all-time highs, when you have deflation, the real level of that debt and the real cost of servicing that debt go up. And so the bubble is going to come from the emerging deflationary environment that is going to cause problems for marginal corporate borrowers in particular. that are going to have trouble servicing those debts in this sort of deflationary environment. That is, I think, where the bubble comes from. The bubble this cycle globally, and especially in the United States, is on corporate balance sheets.
Ira, are you seeing the same thing?
Well, I mean, I don't dig that depth into those areas where David's at. But, you know, again, because so much of my background has been with debt and the way I look at debt, so I do see that corporate concern. And if the economy, and if you do get price deflation, which is, of course, is anathema to debt, and yet we're carrying, you know, I don't care whether you're, if we saw it in Japan, if prices are going down 2% and interest rates are 50 basis points, you're struggling to because the cost of carrying that debt is growing and growing and growing, which is why when people start comparing what's going on here immediately to Japan, I have to step back and say, well, you know, you have a far different situation, especially with the dollar, because the Japanese, when they're now almost three decades, when they embarked on it, 97% of borrowing was domestic, and domestic bondholders certainly didn't mind as long as prices were going down. Basically, you know, you could be receiving, you know, JGBs could be yielding 50 basis points, but in real return, you were getting almost anywhere between 150 and 250 basis points real return on your money. We certainly don't have that here. Now, if prices were to go down, if we were to go into absolute price deflation, yes, and then that debt load, as David points out, on these corporate balance sheets will be the landmine that sets other things off, which is, of course, why we keep hearing that central banks, they don't fear inflation. That's nonsense. They fear deflation, and they'll try to go to any extreme to halt its onset. So I think that David's 100% right, especially on the triple B rated corporate debt that we have now, which grows because, of course, you know, one of the things that happens when you lower interest rates is low, and you create the ability for some of these companies that should have been prevented from borrowing long ago, still being able to borrow to sustain themselves. Their situation only eases if you get, you know, enough inflation. And it's interesting that Professor Rogoff, who's in that book with Carmen Reinhart, one of the premier elements of that, of course, was he needed 5-7% inflation to get out from under that, and he has stopped talking about that. So I think that so coming at it from that regard, from that angle, I certainly agree that that is where that is the premier landmine for the global economy.
And what about the effects of Asia, like in China, tariff issues with the U.S.? How do you see those effects on the economy and the financial markets, David?
Well, I think that the one thing that we do know is that Asia and China, and actually foreign investors in general, seem to have reduced their participation in the U.S. Treasury market, which is then telling you, wow, how is that possible that yields have declined so much? And a lot of that is because the biggest buyers of bonds in the past couple of months have been the commercial banks. And usually they do that when they're looking to increase their liquidity and become more circumspect in their lending behavior. What I'm seeing happening across Asia over and beyond that is a dramatic slowdown, you know, across the continent. Of course, a lot of this coming from the hit and the knock-on effects, you know, from the trade conflict between the U.S. and China. And although we might have a detente right now, the reality is that the White House has already put on $360 billion worth of tariffs on China. And of course, China itself retaliated four times. Those effects will continue to linger for some time. So my sense is that, you know, looking at what's happening across Asia, and And of course, the added political instability that we're seeing in Hong Kong, my sense is that this previous dramatic contributor to global economic growth is now moving in the opposite direction. And I think, again, a key reason, the rapid slowing we're seeing in emerging markets is another key reason why we're entering into a global, if not deflation environment, overall disinflationary environment.
And your thoughts, Ira?
No, I think that's its point right on. You know, and especially when you look at Asia, you know, people forget that if you go back to the 1997-98, the real effect, the real, you know, Asian contagion that we suffered, which was, of course, the vast amount of debt that was taken on. And then you had China, who devalued the currency in 1994. So the yuan, or the renminbi at the time, went from 5.8 to 8.7. And that put all this pressure on global prices, as well as, of course, you know, wages weren't going anywhere because you now had the wall come down, China ramping itself up and setting itself up to be a major player in the global economy, not just their domestic economy. You had the unleashing of a massive amount of labor force, and you had massive amounts of capacity built in Asia. And then the Chinese come and say, well, hold on, we're going to steal everybody's thunder anyway, putting more capacity. So it was the deflationary pressures due to the huge amount of capacity that came onto the global scene. And there's still a lot of capacity overhang in the world. I think that's going to be a continual story of China. And in that regard, David's right, because now throw India in the mix. You know, as I say, the Fed has had the wrong model because they've looked at Nehru, where I look at Nehru, meaning an Indian collar, because the Indians are certainly poised to become a much greater presence on the global market. So, yeah, I agree with that.
And just your final thoughts, gentlemen, on all of these risks, how they affect the financial markets and investments in terms of how they factor in positive or negative. Your thoughts, David?
Well, I'll just say that, you know, what's very interesting is that there's more and more thought and research being put on this unobservable term called uncertainty. And the IMF has been working on this. How do you model uncertainty as an economist? The Fed just completed a report, and they found that, you know, almost a full percent of global economic output has been lost just by this rising and elevated level of political, economic, and financial uncertainty. Not all of it is about trade with China, U.S. For most of this year, we had a trade war between Japan and South Korea. We had now the battle is moving towards the U.S. and the EU. We have Brexit. We have Hong Kong. We have Spain, a weak coalition. In Italy, Bibi Netanyahu can't seem to form a government in Israel. And then we had a hung parliament in Canada. I don't know if I mentioned Brexit, but there's a changed relationship right there. The world is really right now in a state of disarray. People will say, well, the stock market says you're wrong. And I'll say, no, the stock market is just telling me that, you know, people would rather be investing in dividend yields and dividend growth stocks than they would be in the bond market at current yield levels. That's what the stock market is telling you. The stock market's not telling you that the world is a wonderful place. We know that global economic growth is slowing down, and right now slowing down to levels we haven't seen since 2009, and there's no leading indicator telling me that we're going to be reversing that trend. That to me is quite troublesome, especially at these egregiously low levels of inflation. People say, well, who cares about deflation? Well, as I said before, when you get deflation, you know, with hundreds of trillions of dollars of global debt never seen before, it makes it very difficult to service the debt in a deflationary environment. I come back to uncertainty. People say, well, this is a risky environment. I say, risk is not a dirty four-letter word. Risk, at least you can price. Uncertainty is a classic Donald Rumsfeld unknown unknown. Uncertainty, you can't price. And when you look at measured levels of uncertainty, and you can get these measures now from different sources, compilations based on CEO conference calls, based on survey information, based on press clippings. And if you look at the charts of uncertainty on a global basis, they're higher now than they were at the depths of despair in the financial crisis, 9/11, the tech wreck. And so I think that this is something I think that it's very important, because what uncertainty does in your macroeconomic model is when you become more uncertain as an economic participant, you withdraw your spending and you raise your savings. Now, nothing wrong with tightening your belts, that's for sure, and improving your balance sheets, but that comes at the expense of something very near and dear to everybody's heart, especially the bulls, which is GDP growth. So to me, grappling with the uncertainty, the widening confidence intervals that we have around any forecast, that's why the Fed is cutting interest rates, even at a time of full employment, is that the comfort zone around their forecast is not nearly what it used to be. So we're going to be grappling with a heightened level of uncertainty, which means rising savings rates, lower inflation, lower interest rates, lower growth, for not just the next couple of quarters, but for the next couple of years, I'm afraid.
And your final thoughts, Ira, on that?
David digs much deeper into this, so I would certainly you can sense it. And again, risk is not affecting anybody who's involved in capital markets. You know, risk is all part of it, but the type of situations that we have now gotten ourselves into, and I think the great, if there is a risk for the capital markets, it's that the knee-jerk response to QE all over the globe, not just in the U.S., not just, was all these purveyors of this theory, you know, they had a much better handle on it. And, you know, my thing in looking forward for the next year, 2 years, 3 years, is that, again, it's all about the exit. And we saw this. Now, you can exit. There are ways to exit, and there's ways not to exit. I think that they went way too far, and I say way too far because their ability to distort capital markets for that period, and as we're seeing as we head forward, has done great harm. Where instead of actually building balance sheets, the mere threat would have gone a long way to achieve what they wanted, and now they really don't have an exit. Remember, we heard Bernanke say, "Well, the exit won't be a problem because all these instruments will expire and they'll just roll down." Then it was Yellen; it'll be like watching paint dry. And then it was Powell, who was on autopilot, and even the ECB, Draghi, who engaged upon this and then thought, well, this will be either easier to do than previously expected, and no problem. And of course, he had to walk that back. And the Japanese are now trying to figure out how, in fact, they actually get out from under this. So the key to me is exit. And we need to hear more about it, because going forward, that's the way people are going to have to judge how to make investment decisions about what these balance sheets and central bank policy looks like. So that's the uncertainty and the risks that I don't know how to price. And it leaves us in a milieu of great danger, because, again, we don't have any really signaling mechanisms to tell us this. So, where David's convinced, and I'm certainly not in disagreement with it, about that, why rates are where they are, I still struggle under the distortions that have been laid upon the market by global central banks. And I'm watching very closely here to see how the Fed works with the recent turmoil in the overnight lending markets in the U.S. So we have a lot on our plates going forward.
Well, great insight, gentlemen. We'll have to end it there. How can our listeners learn more about your work, David?
Well, you can either call me at 416-681-8919, or email me at drosenberg@gluskinchef.com.
Hey, Ira.
You can always find me at Ira Harris, YiraHARRIS.com. And there you can find a link to Notes from Underground. It's where I blog. I've been blogging less of late because as much as we're facing all these concerns, a lot of this is just rehashing so many of the things. As David said before we started the conversation, it's always the same questions. The answers are just different. And that's the fact. So we have to consider that in light of the questions being the same, but whatever new evidence we've seen revealed. So that's where you can find it.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.